Yeah, we'll get the union on about these part-timers. And of course, anybody who's going to blow their top about that, you can't explain to them that actually the whole trade wouldn't do so well if it were not for that. But I do wonder sometimes, whether there wasn't a little bit of merit in their argument, because how I came to go to George Wharton was, I was a little bit, getting a bit fed up with Norman Crellin, and I was in the plane coming back from Liverpool one time, and I found myself sitting next to George Wharton. So we knew each other by sight, and I said hello, Mr. Wharton, etc. And anyway, he said, will you come and drive for me this coming year? So I said, well, we could certainly talk about it, so come out and see me, and because this was in the winter. So he came out to see me at the house, and we talked around it, and in the end I said, yes, I'd love to, because Highlander was a very successful firm.
How many coaches?
Well, he only had six, but their stand was in Christian Road, which was a four-coach stand, but two round the corner, you see, and that stand was bang in the middle of the road at Christian Road. The cars weren't parked either side like they are now. In fact, they weren't parked there at all. It was a coach stand, and that, which is now a taxi office in Christian Road, George turned into a booking office. Later, we had a booking office down the on the front over on Queen's Prom as well. Anyway, George, I'd been paid £9 a week by Norman Crellin, which was the top rate for drivers at that time, so I was told, and I had no reason to disbelieve it. I'm pretty sure it was. So George and I talked about this, and we agreed on £20 a week. So I was happy to go for that, as you can well imagine.
What year would this be?
This would be, let's see, not I start 54, it would be about 1958. So as he was leaving the house, he said, oh, by the way, he said, there is one thing, he said. My offer of a wage to a driver is dependent always on one thing, and that is that you never discuss your wage with any of the other drivers. I said, that's fine by me. And I never did discuss it until about a year ago, and I met one of my old colleagues with whom I've been sort of friendly over the years, and we got talking about old times, and we were saying George was a good old stick, really, wasn't he, you know, and so on, and I said, and he paid good wages, and Alan said, yes, top wages, he said, £9 a week. So that did make me think, well, I'd already did suspect that perhaps I was getting more than the other drivers. Mind you, I was working the jolly sight better than a lot of other drivers, because I could load a coach when other people couldn't.
On the subject of money, when you got the tips from customers, and also the dropping, was it called?
The dropsy.
The dropsy from the cafe. What percentage of your wages or your overall income was made up from those additional things like the dropsy and the tips?
Well, what you really want is actual figures. When I finished with Highlander, because I did actually go and work weekends afterwards for a couple of other firms, when I was with George, I was still getting £20 a week. Well, it wasn't George, sorry, the business went to John Downward afterwards. I was still getting £20 a week, but I would say I was getting probably, on average, about another £6 to £7 a day. So, and it was 7 days a week, remember. So we're talking 40 to 50 quid a week.
What would you be making a week in your teaching job the rest of the year?
Oh, Lord, when I started, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Look up the Burnham scales, but I don't think, when I started with George at £20 a week, I was getting £20 a week teaching. I'm sure I wasn't. Yeah.
Did your coach ever break down and leave you in the lurch?
About the last trip I ever did. It was Grand Prix day. George Wharton took the whole of the Ginger Hall car park for his coaches, for the races. And we pulled them up with the nose of the coach facing the course. So it was possible, actually, for people to sit in the coach and actually see the race, even if, you know, the people in the back seat could still even get a bit of a view of the bikes flashing by. So if it was raining, it didn't matter. And I was already delayed when I went to pick up my passengers for the Grand Prix. It must have been the Thursday. The Grand Prix was only on Tuesday and Thursday in those days. It must have been on the Thursday. And I went to get some people, and they just weren't there. And I remember it was about 15 people. So that was missing from... I was sent to get them. There weren't ones I'd booked. So I ended up having to go to Ginger Hall very late, with the roads due to close at any time, and I'd only got about 15 people on the coach, and I went like the wind, flat out as far as I could, in this old 32-seater Albion. I loved them. They were very comfortable to drive, very heavy. They were a beautiful thing to drive, but they had no brakes. You know, they were really useless where brakes were concerned. Anyway, flat out in this old thing. But when I got to Balaff, the police put me off the road. You know, the road had closed. So I had to get to Ginger Hall to get round there and get my people to Ginger Hall, though I knew I wouldn't be able to get my coach to Ginger Hall on the back roads. And I just drove it so fast, I did a big ending. And so we had to hobble along there, and the people, fortunately, were able to get to the coach before the roads and the race started, and, you know, the roads closed, you see. But the races were an interesting time, particularly as I used to commentate on the races. There was a box at Sulby Bridge, so Ginger Hall suited me ideally. So I had to get my coach loaded. I had to go because I had to commentate on the races from the box, you see.
Before Manx Radio.
Well, it was before Manx Radio. It was the old round the course commentary. But yes, I did do it for the Manx Radio, the very first time. But we didn't know we were on the air when that very first ever Manx Radio broadcast. We knew it was likely to happen, but it happened on the Wednesday. They just tuned us into tuned Manx Radio into our commentary. But what used to happen then, there used to be midnight boats coming over for the races, particularly on the Friday for the senior race. And we would have, these boats would be coming in from about 4 o'clock in the morning. And we would have coaches pulled up all around down by the sea terminal, you know, there. And we'd be touting, but nobody seemed to mind you touting. And we did, there were all sorts of permutations, but the two basic ones were just a straight trip round the course and back in time for breakfast, or you could do round the course with breakfast en route. And there was sometimes people, you know, had arranged with places en route to give them breakfast. Sometimes, in fact, the only time I ever did it with breakfast was actually the breakfast. We were loaded my coach up in at the pierhead or wherever the heck it was. It wasn't very far. Drove about 50 yards to Walpole Avenue, and they had their breakfast in Walpole Avenue. And then off round the course. Again, sometimes some people did two trips from the boat.
How many coaches would be waiting to meet the boat in a busy period?
Well, probably a 40 or 50, I suppose, yeah. Because the boats would be taking, I think, if the truth were known, about 3,000 people. They were only licensed for about 2,000, but I'm sure they were overladen. And there'd be about that many.
And how many coaches do you think would have been used in the Isle of Man in the sort of, you know, the mid-late 50s?
As many as I'm talking about now. The 50s, although people moaned the seasons are getting bad and all the rest of it, there were still a lot of visitors coming. If you look at the official statistics, I'm sure you'll find that it hadn't dropped off much in that time. I gave up somewhere around the 62, 63, 64, somewhere around that, and I went and did weekends. First of all, for this Jack Edmonds I told you about, who started, he left Highlander, and he started Man in Tourist. An interesting story about that, incidentally. He used the logo. You won't remember, I suppose, the mogul oil. Well, it was a television series about the oil industry, and the firm was called Mogul. And Jack Edmonds pinched this sign for Mogul and used it for his M, his man in tourist. And when the BBC came over to do some filming, they'd hired his coach and they said, "You can't use that." He said, "I can." He'd registered it in the Isle of Man. But he also had two firms going, and one was Tours Isle of Man. And he also had Man in Tourist, and they were both the same colour. Now, his aunt had died and left him some money, had left him a bungalow in Peel, which he sold, and he bought out T.H. Neans with this, or bought a couple of coaches or whatever it was. But it was T.H. Neans anyway. It was enough for a down payment. T.H. Neans was a big firm. Now, that was Jack's own firm, and he would have done that with a bank overdraft, I suppose. And that was, and he changed the name to what he wanted to do was Isle of Man Tours. But the government wouldn't let him register that name because they don't like Isle of Man in a thing. So he said, "Well, can I call it Tours Isle of Man?" And they said, "Yes." And being crafty, he did it in such a way that on the back, the Isle of Man, which was supposed to be in brackets, the brackets were as enormous, and they just looked part of the direction. They looked just like part of the overall logo, and it read Isle of Man Tours, because the tours had this great extension, you see, and above it had Isle of Man. So that was his. But then what he also did was a clever thing. He started this Man in Tourist, which, of course, you should probably appreciate, it has got Russian connotations. And you perhaps really ought to go and interview Jack, because it was an interesting time in the coach history. He went to these one-man firms, and a lot of these guys were getting on in years. And he would say, "Will you sell me your coach?" "Oh, no, I've got a few years left of me yet." "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do," he'd say. You let me paint the coach in my colours, Man in Tourist. Your name will be on it on the license to you. It's still your coach, but I'll buy it off you over the next 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever the person wanted. But it sails, and then you'll be able to use my booking office, this, so and so, and you will get a percentage. And of course, the bloke was quite happy to sell his coach that way, because it kept him in employment for the next few years. And I don't know how many coaches Jack bought up that way, but quite a few. Now, then in the meantime, Corkills, which was just a two little local Onken thing, just two coaches, under Bert Corkle, started to expand, and he started buying other coaches as well, and putting them under the Corkle's flag. And so we now had two big competitors emerging in the coach market. And it was rumoured, strongly rumoured, that Jack Edmonds was going to buy Corkle's up. But in fact, the reverse happened, and they must have made him an offer that he couldn't refuse. But they've kept the name, and the name's still there today, Tours Isle of Man.
Can you remember when the buyout might have been?
No, I'm terrible on dates. I'm terrible on dates. But it was it must have been later than 65, I would have thought, because my last 2 years in the coaches, I went to work for Jack Edmonds in the first of the 2 years, at the airport at weekends, just because there were loads of these inclusive tours coming in. Wallace Arnold had their own coach on the island, but all these other people, Frames and all this, used, I think just Jack Edmonds was the only one. There might have been others. So Frames, Thompsons, all these people were going with Man in Tourist. Not Man in Tourist, I beg your pardon, Tours Isle of Man, but it was the same ownership. And then I also went to work the following year for Hamill's Garage. And Hamill's, in those days when people got off the plane, they wanted to get to Douglas, and they expected to go on an airport bus. Now, the road service did the sort of official one, the BEA or Cambrian or whoever the main carrier was, But all these other carriers, Manx Airlines, Lancashire Air Shuttlecraft Corporation, Delta Airways, Melbourne Airways, all these people, they signed up with Hamels. And so I used to do that.
You mentioned competition with other coach drivers. Was there any competition between the coaches, the trams and the railways? Or did you feel that the railways were going through a bad patch and people weren't interested in railways, they wanted coaches? Or were they still all balancing out together?
We never felt there was any real competition between us and the road service because they had buses and we had coaches. And they weren't really geared. They were working flat out in the summer. The buses were going the whole time in the summer, so they weren't geared to doing tours. And really, to be quite honest, as regards the railway, we didn't ever give them a thought. Talking about competition, though, I'll tell you an interesting story which you might like to know. Of course, there were coaches in other places, Port Erin, for instance, and we, from Douglas, when we were doing this extended tour, which was the, as far as Port Erin and Port Erin were concerned, was the ordinary round the island tour. They did a much more leisurely tour. They didn't get back till 6 o'clock at night. And so these guys from the south of the island, Port Erin coaches, would be in Peel around the same time that we were in Peel. And they, no, I'm sorry, they would have gone to Ramsey, and they would go from Ramsey to the Point of Ayr. We would go from Peel to Point of Ayr. But we arrived at Bride Church around the same time. Now, it's a single-track road. Now, think about it. There's a lighthouse is what you want your people to go up. They can take about 15 people in a light room, okay, and you're all arriving at the same time. 30-seater coaches, 26-seater coaches, whatever, okay? In fact, by this time, that 41-seaters even were coming in. So the driver who got there first was the driver who got away first. The driver who got there last was delayed by a heck of a lot. And so, of course, we just used to race for it. And when I think of the way we used to drive with those people, but we used to say to them, you've got to get up there first, ladies and gentlemen. Most important, I know we're giving you a bit of a rough drive here, but pardon me, I know what I'm doing. And, of course, you couldn't overtake. It was impossible until you got clear of the last hedge and you were out into the sort of open plain there. And then beyond that were the gates of the lighthouse. You could go through those gates and it was still pretty open. So they were very sedate and well-behaved, these Port Erin drivers. And what we used to do was overtake them then, okay? Well, you still had to park your coach. Well, of course, then I realised one day that I missed out because of the way the coach was parked and the people got off another coach ahead of me. So what I used to do thereafter was flat out overtake anybody, scream to a halt, right across at an angle across the gate so that these other kids, these other passengers couldn't get off because my coach was blocking it one way and only my people, like going out through my door, could get in through the thing. And we were full of tricks like that, you know, and how some of us didn't get our nose punched in, I don't know, but there was a great camaraderie. People took it in part. You beat me today, Kelly, but you'll not beat me tomorrow sort of thing, you know.
Can you remember any particularly memorable happy days when, you know, you'd be having a really good time?
I enjoyed the whole thing. I really did. Not everybody did. One fellow who now runs a taxi firm down the south of the island here, like me and like a lot of us, didn't like to see the hat going round. A poor driver would pass that around. He would say something like, "Oh yes, thank you very much, sir." And then he would say to the passenger, "Oh, the gentleman at the back just said, would I pass the hat round?" And that was the mark of a poor driver. Because I hated to see the hat go round, because people would not be seen giving you less than half a crown in your hand or a pound or whatever, but they would put coppers into a hat. So you never did well when the hat went round. And this particular chap I'm talking about, who's now got a taxi firm down the south of the island, he was very wild, wild man. And the hat went round despite all his... He had quite an elaborate routine to make sure the hat didn't go round.
How did he try?
Well, what he used to do was, again, he reversed what I've just told you about, which thank you very much, sir. He used to pretend somebody had already spoken to him. And if he saw anybody standing up, with the, which he thought, that person's going to pass the hat round, he would say, do you mind sitting down, please, sir? But I want to... No, please sit down, sir. And he said, I want to say something. And so the fellow would sit down. He said, while I was in Ramsey, he'd be coming up the mountain, you see, he'd say, while I was in Ramsey, a gentleman did say he would like to make a collection on my behalf. But thank you very much. I'd much sooner it if you didn't make a collection, because I do feel that it's up to you. If you want to show your appreciation for me, I'd be very glad if you'd like to do that when you get out of the coach. Now, I thought, you know, I hadn't quite got that sort of neck to do that. But I just used to hope it wouldn't go around. But this particular bloke who went through that spiel, and he was just telling me the other day, he only told me that the other day. But I remember this incident well. The hat went round for him, and there was a lot of copper in it, of course, and he threw it down the aisle. He threw it. What do you think I am? Look at all that sunburned money you've given me. What do you think I am? You can pick it up and take it home if that's all you think of me. Well, I mean, I would have just settled for it. But that was coming back from... Now, I told you I had pioneered the Port Erin only trip. Well, the other big one I pioneered, when I took a bit of a chance on this, was the Ocean Bar. And it's coming back from the Ocean Bar that this sunburned money incident occurred.
The Ocean Bar would be...
Right. Yeah. Well, it was in Ramsey. Now, there was an advocate called John Christian who owned a beach hotel in Ramsey. And he had been in the same class at school as my brother-in-law, who also was a coach driver. And one time, coming up to TT week, just before the season started, my brother-in-law Robin said to me, John Christian's got a new bar in his beach hotel, and he wants me to go and have a look at it to see if we can get coach passengers down. Will you come and have a look at it with me? So... I said, yes. So we went, wow, I thought, this is just what coaches need, something new here. There was an illuminated glass dancing floor. The bar was all wrought iron and illuminated glass behind. He was going to put a cabaret act on every night. I thought, great. So I said, well, are you going to do trips to it, Robin? No, I'm not interested, he said. So I said, right. I said to John Christian, if... I'll guarantee you, now I remember I was only a driver, and I said, I'll guarantee you two coaches a night, provided you don't serve any other coach. Because I said, you've tried all sorts of things here, which he had. He'd tried barbecues, and every coach in the Isle of Man would turn up, and he couldn't cope. And then the news would go round, John Christian's having another barbecue. Well, not if it's like last time my people didn't get served. I got no tips that night, and then nobody would turn up. So I said, now you've tried these things. I said, what you need is consistency. He said, that's true. I said, I'll bring you two coaches if you promise you won't do anybody else. Well, when I went back and told John Downwood it was by this time I was working for, that was hiring the coaches still. What have you done? What have you done? What's this Ocean Bar? What is it? I said, just leave it to me. And using all my teaching expertise, I made out a board on the Queen's Prom booking office, and then I did one for up in Christian Road. Children's playroom. I thought that was quite an important thing because there was a children's... So that had quite a bit of prominence. Free cabaret, you know. Illuminated glass dancing floor, you know, all this. The Ocean Bar, didn't say where the heck it was, didn't say it's in Ramsey, you know, just said trip to the ocean. Didn't say it was free admission, I beg your pardon. I said £5 including admission. That was what I put, you know, what, see, £5 including admission. Well, we'd loaded those two coaches off the board before you could say Jack Robinson. So we went down, and I said I only told him two, so let's see how the two work out. So we went down that first night, two coaches, and... sure enough, the people had a good time, and this salamander fellow, the fire eater come Houdini expert, was there, and Count Morency, polyphonologist, one-man band, was there, and it was really good. So I'd asked John to come down with me. He came down. I said, I reckon that's John Downward. I reckon we'll squeeze another couple of coaches in here. So he said, yeah, so let's see how it goes. So the next night we had four coaches there, and they never had less than four. In fact, after I left there and they were still doing Ocean Power, they ran it in two shifts. It was so successful.
Can you remember if you ever had any particularly bad, dark days where either things would go wrong for you or there'd be people giving you trouble and grief?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, when I was driving that Monas Queen, it had what was called a floating body. Now, a floating body is supposed to make the coach that much more comfortable, because the body was simply attached at its lowest point. It was attached to the chassis, all on the one level, but it was attached nowhere else, which means that when the wind, where the windscreen came down to the dashboard, what they had there, like a lot of double-decker buses still to this day have this floating body, it was not attached to the scuttle of the dashboard. It was loose, and it just had a piece of rubber there to mask the gap. So the body moved even when the dashboard was still, so that if you went round a corner or over a bump, the body would move, but it wouldn't be pulling the whole coach over. The coach was really only moving as much as the floor was moving, you see. Well, this coach, DMN 93, the Monas Queen, she'd worked all through the war when taking workers to Derby, so she was an old coach. She was 1938 one, but she, I'm saying 1954 when I first started. Yeah, 54. And she'd been going all that time, so she was pretty old, pretty ripe, and never mind floated, it was fully floated. It was near sinking more than anything. And every blessed screw that held the beading on the side for decoration was all loose, and they spent the winter going around with self-tappers, you know, tightening it all up. Well, also, like a lot of coaches that time, it had a sunshine roof. Yes, sunshine roof. Well, the sun would come through it, but also the rain would come through it, and then every other part of the roof. So the back seat was always a nightmare on any of the coaches of that era. And when it rained, the people on the back with plastic mats and so on, they umbrellas, everything, and of course they'd paid full whack, you know, you just dreaded the rain coming because the thing would be, you know, they flooded out on the back seat, that's all there is. It was just absolutely pouring in because it all collected at the back. The drain holes and everything for the sunshine roof went back that way, and they probably leaked as well. But talking about a black day, we always carried a little stool or stools with us so that you could put the half fare in. A child could sit on a stool. Now, it was actually strictly against the rules and regulations, but on the whole, the police and so on turned a blind eye to that. If you got a load of kids and you put one on a stool, I mean, you wouldn't get away with it today with seatbelt regulations and whatever. But one of the dangers for bosses was that drivers were dishonest. One boss once said to a driver in my presence, "Is that all you've got?" he said, because they used to take the fares. I incidentally, when I went to work for George Wharton, said, I won't tell anybody about the salary, but I've got a condition as well, and that is that I never have to collect a fare. You collect the fares. But anyway, the drivers, what they would do, they collect the fares themselves. Or even they gave them to the boss or didn't give them to the boss, it didn't matter, but they'd go round the corner and they'd have three or four passengers stashed away there, which they'd pick up, and then that money they would keep, you see. So they were very dishonest on the whole. And this boss said, I've heard about one wheel for the driver and three for the boss, but with you, he said, it's three wheels for the driver and one for the boss. Is that all the money you've got to show me at the end of the day, you see? So But this event occurred before I did that arrangement with George Wharton about the money. It was when I first went with Norman, and I did used to collect the fares. And it's funny how when we got back, we never agreed. Now, I can tell you, I was always scrupulously honest, so much so that at the end of that first year, he had made so much more money that year compared with other years, he was able to buy another coach. He bought one, a 20-seater of Freddie Gash, for £80. But however, so he should have known I was jolly well honest. But anyway, this particular day, I pulled into Ramsey with my load, and people got off, and I could see a policeman waiting there. And Bill Schumann, who was the vehicle inspector, driving test examiner and all the rest of it. And I knew Bill quite well. And he had served his time with my mother. And and I got off. He said, "Can I have a look at the coach?" I said, "Yes." You know, the public service vehicle examiner. I couldn't say no, so I had to look. Well, he pushed the body. He just, with his own hands, he was only slightly built, and he put his hands against the body. Well, it creaked and groaned and moaned, and it moved, I should say, at least 9 inches to probably a foot. He could just shake this body. he said, "There's some movement there." And I said, "Well, it's a semi-floating body or something." He said, "It's fully floating." And anyway, so he said, "And there's this screw missing here and that screw missing." They were all these body screws which holding the beading on, which had fallen out. So he looked at this, that, and the next thing. And he said, "I have to take this vehicle off the road right now." He said, "It's not fit to be on the road."